Over thousands of years, languages evolved in order to provide mankind a mechanism for making it easier to communicate with one another. Today, the world is filled with a wide variety of different languages, some of which are radically different from one another, while others bear striking similarities. When the conversation is not between people, but between a person and a machine, there too, languages have evolved to facilitate the transfer of information, instructions, and intent. Just as with the spoken language, there have evolved a wide variety of programming languages, each of which attempts to provide a better way to communicate between man and machine. Understanding, designing, and evangelizing some of these languages and the programming methodologies within them is Eric Meyer. Hello, I'm Robert Hess, and I'll be your host today as we talk with Eric Meyer, Principal Architect for the Cloud Programmability Team. I hope you enjoy this chance to look at the technology and the person behind the code. Eric grew up in the Dutch Antilles, and then the Netherlands, where a fascination at an early age with bottling wine at a brewery had him thinking he wanted to become a mechanical engineer, a fascination which led to the regular dismantling of various toys and things around the house. But this gradually became overshadowed by an interest in programming, a potentially less destructive pastime, and the stage was set for what was to come. Join me now as I welcome today's guest, Eric Meyer.
Thank you, Robert.
Glad to join us, Eric.
Yes.
Now, I actually understand this isn't your first time on video here at Microsoft.
That's correct. So I am in this very same studio. I played Hat in the Box for Visual Basic TV.
VBTV. Oh,
VBTV,
I remember
that. Yes.
As a matter of fact, I think we've got a clip of that.
Oh, right. Wow. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. All right. Hey!
Oh,
whoa.
Man.
Dude. What you got going on in there, man?
Just smoking some, burning some incense.
Burning some incense,
oh,
are
yeah,
you?
Yeah.
Having a little party going on in
yes,
there?
Oh, yes. Can you help me clean up a little
sure,
bit?
Yeah, absolutely. Must be
nice to
So, that looked like a lot of fun.
That was an incredible amount of fun, yes.
I understand, you actually shaved your head for that.
I did, yes.
I don't think I'd shave my head for the show, but...
Yeah.
No, I understand that, let's go way back in time, I understand you actually grew up on the islands of the Dutch Antilles.
That's correct.
Now, maybe some people in our audience aren't quite as geographically challenged as I can be sometimes, but when I think of Dutch Antilles, no actual place on the globe pops to mind. Where is that at exactly?
The Dutch Antilles are like a couple of islands in the Caribbean. There's three islands near the coast of Venezuela. And then there's three islands further out into the ocean.
So we're actually talking South America then?
We're talking South America, yes. So it's really like a tropical paradise. When you're a kid, that's all you can ever wish for. We would go sailing and swimming to the beach all the time. I did a lot of sports like tennis and I was a competitive swimmer. And the nice thing there is also that the schools, because it's so hot, the school started at, I think it was 6:30 in the morning until 12:30 in the afternoon. So the whole afternoon was off, which, I could go and spend my time. I spent also a lot of time just walking in the bush, like playing as a kid. It was really very nice.
Mm-hmm. So was it on then the island of Curaçao where you encountered this bottling line that you said got your fascination?
Yes, so there's a famous brewery on the island. So the island, as I said, is very dry. So what they do for water is they distill seawater. And I don't know whether it's real because, well, I was a kid, I didn't drink the beer. But the marketing thing was that because it was made with this special distilled water, this was the purest tasting beer in the universe. And then at school, when you have like a little school trip, one day we went to the brewery, and that really impressed me. The bottling lines where you have like hundreds of bottles with lots of noise and, all the kind of, the robot hands coming down, lifting up the bottles and so on. I was completely fascinated by that. And from then on, that was my dream to design factories, like it's a little bit like the Charlie Chaplin creating factories with complicated machines that automatically do things.
Mm-hmm. I mean, because if you think about back in those days, those complex mechanics were the high technology of the day.
And yes.
Even today, I remember, you know, seeing things, whether it was on cartoons or TV shows, where the big thing was showing all these mechanisms moving together. And I can understand your fascination from that standpoint.
Yeah. And it's also not only, it was not only the fascination of the machines, but also the whole process. If you know, I don't know, probably a lot of people know how beer is made, but they have this kind of giant, beautiful copper kettles. And then what goes in is like, you know, grain and things like that. And then first it's like this black, ugly smelling, you know, stuff. And then in the end it's something that foams and is clear. So also the kind of chemical process, that was also the combination of this mechanics plus the chemistry. That really fascinated me, seeing this transformation from, you know, from grain to something in a bottle. I really liked that. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Did you ever try actually designing your own equipment at all, or was it just all ripping things apart?
When I was a kid, it was mostly ripping things apart. When I was older, I liked to make, I tried to make my own furniture, and I built speakers. So a little bit, but I still something that, you know, if I ever retire, I would like to, you know, design something kind of, you know, real, like a factory or something, like really mechanical. Mm-hmm.
So like doing a case mod on your computer or something like that, a nice little mechanical case for it, for doing all the things for you?
Well, I did actually. So that is somewhat later when I was in high school. The Philips, so I grew up when I moved to the Netherlands in a little town called Weert, which is close to Eindhoven. And Eindhoven is where Philips, the big Dutch electronic company, is. And the Philips people made an Apple II clone from FPGAs. This was, I think, in the late 70s. And I think it was quite advanced. And then there was like a computer club where you could buy boards. So I, with some friends from high school, we bought one of those boards and we soldered it together. And then later somebody gave me a real Apple II case, an old case. So I kind of, you know, put that board, which was a clone, into the case and
to all appearances, you then had an Apple II, even though it really wasn't.
Yeah. It wasn't, yes. Yeah. And another thing we did is, this was way before laser printers and so on, and there were the first typewriters, electronic typewriters, and we also modded them to put an RS, 232 interface on there, so we could use the typewriter as our printers. Mm-hmm. I think this was a Brother typewriter. Mm-hmm.
So the typewriter wasn't originally meant to be a printer at all, but you converted it into
it. Yes, yeah. So internally, you know, you could kind of rewire some of the electronics and then use it as a printer.
Yeah, that sounds like a pretty good challenge then for you.
Yeah.
So when did you move from the Dutch Antilles up to Netherlands?
So we moved when I was 14. That's also an interesting story. In the olden days, living in the tropics was not very healthy because, you know, tropical diseases and things like that. So the great thing is when you would work in the Dutch Antilles, you would retire when you were 50. The funny thing is that now a lot of people go, after they retire, they go live there because the climate is so nice. But so my dad was retired when he was 50, and then we moved back to the Netherlands. And then he continued to work, but then we moved the whole family back.
Mm-hmm. Now, I can only imagine that must have been a really big change for you. I mean, only living down the Dutch Antilles, a nice tropical climate and stuff like that, and then suddenly moving to the Netherlands, where I imagine it's a lot colder and a lot harsher climate.
Yes. So my rule is that people can only live where palm trees can grow. So the Netherlands definitely doesn't qualify for that. Seattle, nearly. So we have a couple of palm trees in our garden now. So every time I look out of my kitchen window, I see the palm trees. So I kind of remind myself, yeah, you know, it's possible. But yes, the Netherlands is very cold and very wet.
Then when do you actually get into programming itself? I mean, it sounds like, you know, programming a typewriter to be a printer, that's a bit of programming on the hardware level. But regular software programming, when did that come in?
Yeah, so I had a friend who got a TRS-80. So now you can see how old I am. And he was really proud of that. So he said, come over, you have to see this. So I went over, and he tried to explain BASIC to me. So the thing was programmed in BASIC. And one of the things that he tried to show me was dim x equals x plus 1. And I just couldn't understand that, because there is no x such that x equals x plus 1. And he kept explaining, no, Eric, that doesn't mean x equals x plus 1. It means x becomes x plus 1. And at that point, I thought, okay, I really need to understand this. And that's why when I got more interested in programming as opposed to the more mechanical engineering part. Because this, the fact that you could have this machine and then write something and make the machine work, that sounded a lot kind of easier, where you have much more control than when you have to really build things. So it's, in some sense, it's very similar, because you're creating a machine that does something that you want it to do. But with software, I think it's much easier to achieve that. You're not bound to the laws of physics. Mm-hmm. And that freedom, I think, is something that I really enjoyed in the rest of my career, where it's more the limit is only your imagination instead of nature.
Right. It's not a physical device you're having to challenge yourself with, but it's more like an esoteric concept that you're programming instead.
Yeah. So I think, on the one hand, I think it's good to have limitations, because limitations, that makes you creative if you kind of try to restrict what you can do. But the nice thing about the computer is that the restrictions are a little bit less severe than in real life. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Now, other than BASIC, which you got to start off, and most programmers get their start on BASIC, whether it's on a TRS-80 or an Apple II or whatever, what were some of the other early programming languages you dealt with?
Yeah, so when maybe I should tell you a little bit more about the history. So after I got fascinated by this BASIC programming, it turned out that in the Netherlands, they started just that year, they started the first computer science degree. Before that, you could do computer science, but it was part of math or physics, so it was like a minor. But this was the first time you could do a major in computer science. So I thought, well, that's a good opportunity I like new things. So I signed up for computer science. And then when we started, I was kind of bored, because we had to do a lot of assembly programming and things like that. So I think it's called these days, it's a black hat hacker. So I was really kind of, going down the wrong path. And also because what they did is they put us, they had a special subversion of the operating system for students. It was an IBM 370, and they had something called student CMS, where they try to put us in a sandbox. And when you tell that to me, I want to break out of the sandbox. So I was spending more of my time hacking than doing computer science. And then one of the professors, Professor Raymond Boete, called me into his office and had a chat with me. And one of the things that he showed me was actually this. So this is programming in Prolog. Prolog was at that time a language that the Japanese used for the fifth generation project. Mm-hmm. And that was an idea where they wanted to make computers, like artificial intelligence and so on. So he showed me that, and then he showed me another programming language called CECL, St. Andrew's Static Language. Both of these languages, Prolog is based on logic, mathematical logic, and CECL is based on mathematical functions. And suddenly I got interested in these languages, because I could finally understand them. If you would write, x equals x plus 1, it meant x equals x plus 1 instead of x becomes x plus 1. So when I discovered these high-level, very abstract languages that are really executable mathematics, so to speak, suddenly computer science really started to live for me.
Mm-hmm. And so, after you moved into SASL and Prolog and other languages like that, What did that do for you as an individual, as a way of learning the programming model itself?
Yeah, so for me, like one of the things that I really like, as I said, it's that fascination that I have since childhood, like doing long division where you it's a kind of mechanical process, right? You take two numbers and then there's an algorithm that you apply to come up with the solution. If you're looking at calculus, you're integrating something, or maybe differentiation is a better example. So there's rules, you know, if I want to differentiate the composition of two functions, you know, these are the rules. So you're really calculating, you're doing a process, you're looking at your problem statement, and then you're applying a number of steps in order to get to the solution. The nice thing about functional programming is that you can calculate your programs too. So in some sense, your programs are now objects like numbers, and you can apply things like long division. So I can take a program and I look at it and I say, oh, I see this, I can apply this rule and now I get a new program. So you start with a program in general that is obviously correct, but not very efficient. And then you calculate until you get an efficient version of your program. And that way of programming really appeals to me. And that's much harder in imperative programming, because the programs are not very suited for this manipulation. On the other hand, what you see now in things like Visual Studio, where people talk about refactoring. Refactoring is in some sense taking your program and manipulating it in order to create a new program that does the same, but does it maybe in a more clear way or more efficient way. But in functional programming, it's really extreme refactoring. So the way you program is by constantly refactoring. And that's very similar to other branches of mathematics. Mm-hmm. So that definitely shaped the way I deal with programming.
And that was your first job out of college?
In 86, that's when I graduated. So I should say it was kind of, you know, from 85 until 1990, that kind of period.
Mm-hmm. And then what did you do after that?
So after that, I worked on my PhD thesis in that area. My PhD thesis was on calculating a compiler. So I explained to you about calculational programming. Now, a big problem is when you define a programming language is you have to provide an implementation of the programming language. And the way that's usually done is you translate one programming language into another. And usually the machines on which we execute these programming languages is a very low-level machine. And if you have a very high-level language, then that gap, the semantic gap, is quite large. So what I try to do is to define, there's something called denotational semantics, where you basically express the meaning of your program in some mathematical terms. And that sounds extremely theoretical, but what I try to do is to take that description, which is very precise, and then in a series of little steps, move it closer and closer to the actual machine. Such that at every step you know that the meaning is preserved, so that in the end you know that if I compose all these steps, the result, if I compile this program to that program, it's still correct. So that was, I think, a quite nice application. And then for a while after, I think that's everybody, after they do their PhD, there's a little fatigue of, you know, you've been doing this thing for 4 or 5 years. So I went and did asynchronous circuits.
And then where do you think your big idea about your career came about, of what you wanted to do, and you wanted to be like a language expert?
Yeah, so I one of the things, and I brought this here, this is actually my first language that I designed. Oh, I should probably show it here. You see, this is like an old matrix printer. It was a language I did when I was a PhD student.
So the whole language is here?
The whole language is here. It's written in Miranda, which is a functional language. That fascination with designing programming language started way back early in college. One of the professors I had there was Kees Koster. Kees Koster was one of the designers of ALGOL 68, a language that was way ahead of its time. And he was like a serial language designer. So he designed ALGOL 68 and CDL, CDL2. And I was really inspired by that. So my dream was to also design my own language. And so that's kind of, you know, what I did all along. And then this, my PhD work on calculate and compilers was maybe driven by complete egocentric reasons, because if you're designing a language, you have to build a compiler. And as we know here, like in Visual Studio, there's giant teams that build compilers. Building compilers is not easy. So I thought maybe if I can make that easier, you know, I can design more languages. So I've been designing languages since I was in college. Then at some point, so this was a functional language. Functional languages, a lot of people nowadays talk about functional languages, but they're actually quite old. So in the 70s or in the 80s, people were doing functional languages too. And then there was a trend to unify. So there were a lot of little functional languages. And then a number of people came together and said, why are we kind of wasting our efforts and everybody's trying to build their own implementation of a functional language? So they came together and said, let's define a standardized functional language as a kind of a research platform, and then everybody can experiment on top of that. So we can share that work of building this compiler, and then everybody can experiment on top, on the high level. And that language is called Haskell. And I got involved with that. Haskell is still, I think, one of the few pure functional languages that really is like in the line of Cecil, that's really mathematically oriented. It's still designed by a group of international experts all around the world. Simon Peyton-Jones, who is in Microsoft Research Cambridge, is the maintainer of the compiler. So I worked on that for a long time, and at that point I thought, oh, it's really nice to have, you know, to build these compilers and so on, but maybe I should do something practical. Maybe you got the impression now that, you know, this guy is like out there, you know, doing math. And I got the opportunity to take a sabbatical at the Oregon Graduate Institute. The Oregon Graduate Institute at that time was a center of excellence of functional programming. I spent several summers there visiting for a couple of months, collaborating with them. What they did was interesting. They took a functional program and then compiled it into Ada. So you would write a very high-level description, and then they would compile it into the language that was required by the Department of Defense.
Because Ada was that language basically designed by committee.
Exactly.
That tried to be Fortran and C and
exactly.
Pascal and everything at once.
Yeah. And so what you would do is you would, you know, write your code in this high-level language, and then you would generate this giant Ada program, and then people here were happy, and the people here were happy. Anyway, so I went there, and this was in 97, and this was before the first internet bubble burst. And I was there in not Silicon Valley, but, you know, in Oregon, Portland, Oregon, and I got caught by the internet bug, and I decided, well, maybe I should leave all this theoretical stuff, you know, with mathematics and so it behind, and try to apply that to the real world. So what I did before I went there, this is a real life-changing sabbatical. Before, what I did is I tried to take some mathematics and try to find an application in the real world. And now what I try to do is to take something from the real world and try to find some mathematics that could help me solve that. So I really kind of switched my thinking around. And one of the big things, and this is still like more than 10 years later, I'm still working on this, is how do you deal with writing programs that span the internet?
And by spanning the internet, that internet's pretty big. So how do you?
But the thing is, like when you interact with the internet, you know, you think that you're in your browser, but that browser goes to all websites, and on those websites programs are run, and on your browser programs are run. So you're talking about a huge distributed system that you have to program. And that's a huge challenge. So I kind of made a complete leap from writing these little programs where I had full control and I could do like long division and kind of calculate them, to saying, okay, how can we program these kind of giant distributed programs? And what kind of math can we use to help us with that? And so while I was at the Oregon Graduate Institute, we built a lot of technology based on Haskell, the language, this functional language. One of the things we did is we made a binding between Haskell and COM, Microsoft COM, and with C, with imperative programs. At that point, I realized that, again, once you start trying to solve real-world problems, that you cannot stay in your nice box. You can write your nice functional programs, but you want to use libraries, GUI libraries, network libraries. So we had to interface between, you know, this pure, beautiful functional language and
the ugly outside world.
And the ugly outside world. So I spent a lot of time on that. And actually, that is really satisfying, this interplay between theory and practice. And I think I started to enjoy that even more when I moved from theory first and then practice to practice first and then theory.
So it sounds then that Haskell was kind of your foot in the door to bring you to Microsoft finally.
That's correct. Yeah, so Haskell, via Simon Peyton-Jones and Microsoft Research, was the entry to Microsoft. The other thing that we realized, as we talked about in the beginning, I lived on the Dutch Antilles when I was young. I had two kids by that time, and I thought it was also good for the kids to see a different part of the world. I think it's good to, you know, not live in the same place all of your life. So that's when we decided maybe we should just, you know, immigrate and take everything we have, you know, and move to Redmond.
So you and your family were actually still living in the Netherlands at that time.
We were still living in the Netherlands. We did a one-year sabbatical in Oregon. We moved back, and then we realized, you know, it's really nice to have the opportunity to explore the world as well.
Okay, and you wanted that tropical climate that we have here in Seattle, right?
Yes. but to be honest, if you look at on the map, Seattle is quite far south. If you look at Europe, it's like, you know, at the level of Bordeaux, whereas the Netherlands is much more north. That's mm-hmm. like up in Canada somewhere. So yes, the climate is much better here. It's still not, you know, palm trees grow, so it's kind of, you know, it qualifies. The other thing, of course, is beautiful about Seattle is that there's mountains and ocean everywhere, you know, just within 1 hour drive. So it's a very pleasant place to live.
Mm-hmm. I definitely think so.
Yes.
So what group did you first start off working out here at Microsoft?
So I started to work in the CLR team, the Common Language Runtime team. And the CLR, I think it's still quite a unique experiment. Right now it's not an experiment anymore.
But it's an actual product.
It's
now,
an actual product, and it has, and .NET has been around, I think now it has its 10th anniversary pretty soon. The nice thing about the remarkable thing about it is that it really tries to embrace multiple languages. And this diversity in languages is very important. I mean, we talked a lot about programming languages. I don't think that there's one programming language that solves all problems or that fits everybody. So there will always be a diversity of language, and there will always be new languages. And in some sense, the idea of the CLR is very similar to the idea behind Haskell, where you say, okay, let's factor out all the kind of common work that we can do for all languages, and then on top of that, each language can innovate by itself. And if you look at the CLR, what you do is you say, every language, or a lot of languages, need garbage collection. So if we build one garbage collector, now all the languages can share that. All languages, all compilers need a code generator. Well, we have a high-level intermediate language in the CLR that's called MSIL. So you compile to MSIL, and then from there to machine code, that's taken care of by the CLR. So you get a lot of reuse, and now each language can concentrate on what they're good at and innovate in that space. And the same with Visual Studio. There's a lot of language services that Visual Studio provides, and then each language can kind of build on top of that. So that really appealed to me. And that's why I joined the CLR team. Mm-hmm. Then when I was in the CLR team, I collaborated with Wolfram Schulte from Microsoft Research, where when we were way back when he was an academic, we collaborated as well on using Haskell for doing GUI programming. And then here I hooked up with him again, and we wrote a ThinkWeek paper on integrating XML into C#. And the ThinkWeek process is, I'm not sure if that's familiar with everybody, but...
Yeah, the audience probably has never heard it. It's a Microsoft thing.
It's a Microsoft thing. So when Bill Gates was still here, he would, I think, twice a week would go, I think the myth is that he would go to a cabin somewhere, maybe that's true, I don't know, and he would take a stack of papers from...
Twice a year.
Twice a year, yes. Yeah. Where people could submit papers to the ThinkWeek process, and then Bill would sit down and read them and comment on them. Now that Bill's gone, there's still ThinkWeek. It's more like a traditional kind of conference where there's a large group of people that reviews them. But with Bill, it was really Bill's ThinkWeek. So Wolfram and I wrote a ThinkWeek paper on that, and Bill was quite positive about it. One of the things he said, that doesn't look that hard to implement, which was like famous last words. So we wrote that paper, and then a group in Web Data and SQL Server was also looking at integrating data into programming languages. And William Adams was the person that was leading that team, and he hired me from the CLR team into Web Data. And that was a little incubation project where I think it was like 5 or 10 people, depending how you count, where we were experimenting with another language targeting the CLR that had XML integration and SQL integration in there. And you can see it's like a direct continuation of the work I did in Haskell, where I was trying to write this internet scale programming language that could deal with data tier and the middle tier and the client tier. And now what we did is we transposed all that into, instead of using Haskell, we used C# as our basis. So we worked on that for a number of years. And the language was first called X#, and then it was called Xen. And then it ended up being C Omega. What we did is, after a while, we had a prototype, and we were kind of finished. And then we worked with, there was one thing missing, and that was to deal with concurrency. If you're talking about web programming, there's obviously concurrency and distribution. For example, if you want to make a mashup, I want to take the stock quotes from this service and maybe the temperatures from that service and then mash them up on the client. And the guys in MSR Cambridge had a very nice concurrency mechanism called join patterns. They had a language called polyphonic C#, another C# experiment. And what we did is we collaborated and we took polyphonic C# with Xen and we created something called C Omega. So C Omega was the prototype where we had XML integration, SQL integration, and concurrency. And that was a very nice thing, but again, it was still not like a product. And then what I did
is more of a research tool.
It's a research tool. And the interesting thing, too, is that we took the thing that we built in this incubation team and we transferred that back to research. So there was like input from research into this, and then it went from the product team to research. So it's kind of a nice reverse technology transfer. And that's also what I like. I like there's this big circle where research inspires products, but then the products themselves inspire research. And then you get a nice cycle that, you know, enforces itself. So that was what we did. But then also we worked with the actual product teams, with the Visual Basic teams and the C# teams, to take the ideas that we developed and put them in the real programming languages. And then I spent, after working on that incubation for a couple of years, I spent then 2-3 years working with the Visual Basic team and the C# team to take the ideas that we developed in C-Omega and to put them into C# and Visual Basic. And things that came out of that was Link, a language integrated query. And in Visual Basic, we have the VB XML literals. So these are two things that you see, you know, that we experimented with in C-Omega, and that then came from Haskell. So there's a long kind of road from theory to practice to get these things, you know, really polished such that normal programmers can use it.
Now, when I use Link in my C# applications, it almost feels like I'm using a different language inside of it. I mean, you got your C# module doing things. Suddenly, I'm now using vars, where I didn't have vars before that I was using in C#, and I'm, you know, creating these constructs that take a form that are different than C#. Is that a correct way of looking at it?
That's a correct way of looking at it. So that's another interesting trend that you see in the programming language world, where maybe I would say 10, 20 years ago, the programming language world was really balkanized, where all languages were very different. There were functional languages, object-oriented languages, maybe procedural languages, and people were really talking in terms of that. But again, if you look at them, they're really much more similar than different. And people slowly started to realize that, and a lot of concepts, people are borrowing. So the object-oriented people are borrowing things from functional programming and vice versa. And what you see with Link in C# is that things are, you know, it's like a mixture of languages. The var, for example, that you mentioned, normally when you write a program in C# and you declare a variable, you have to declare what its type is. Now, the thing is that the compiler, if you make a mistake there, the compiler will tell you, oh, you said it was an integer, but I inferred that it was a string. Now you can say, well, why, instead of letting the compiler tell you that's an error, why don't you allow the programmer to leave that type declaration out, and now the compiler will just infer it for you. So it is a lot less work to write. So that's where you see with var. That was something that was a very well-known technique in functional programming before. So that we see that was transferred to C#. The language when you write Link, where you write it in a different form, that is definitely something that looks strange at first. But then if you think about it, in C#, or in many languages, if you write a for each loop in C#, that really means, you know, you can write that for each loop, but the compiler takes that and translates that into a simpler form in a while loop with, you know, a try catch around it. But then if you look at the while loop, that itself is an abstraction for, say, a go to. So, and now if you think back about what I talked about, transformational programming, C# is structured like that too. You write this for each loop. Really, the compiler translates that into a while loop, which is really an abbreviation for this go-tos and so on. So you kind of, again, it's like slowly unfolding that higher level concept and expressing it into more primitive things. If you look at Link, the same thing happens. You write what looks like a SQL query, But the compiler takes that and translates that into lower level primitives. And then those are translated into the lower level primitives as well. So it's in some sense very much the same concept. Mm-hmm. But by doing that, you make the language more and more powerful in the sense that you can write things in a very concise way instead of expressing everything in painstaking detail at the low level of abstraction.
Sort of pushing and popping registers, you're actually...
Exactly,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah. But now, when you're talking about using a link, link to me still has a var x equals blah, which is not asynchronous. That's a synchronous sort of model. How do you take and set that up so it can be asynchronous?
Yeah, so again, that is the kind of magic of link. And maybe I should make a quick detour to talk about the mathematical basis of link and how we're kind of going full circle to the beginning. One of the things that an interesting part of mathematics is called category theory. And category theory was invented by the mathematicians when they saw that, say, linear algebra and group theory were very similar. So they tried to kind of abstract from the essence of that. So it's like, what is common in that? And can we come up with a notation that, you know, shares the commonality between these seemingly different concepts? And that led to category theory, very, very abstract branch of mathematics. Now, people have discovered in the functional programming community is that those ideas apply to programming as well. And the ideas as follows is that if you think about a value like the number 5, you can look at that number 5, but that's really not very interesting because the number 5, where did it come from? So there was a computation that created the number 5. So you compute something and then out comes the number 5. So the idea of category theory is to distinguish between values and the computation of that value.
So it'd be similar to like an Excel spreadsheet where you see a cell with a number in it, and sometimes the number was typed in and sometimes the number actually calculated from other things.
Yes, so Excel is a very good example. You see the numbers there, but if you click on that number, you see that there might be a little formula that is the computation of that number. And by focusing on the computation instead of the actual result, you get this extra level of indirection. And that's what we're leveraging. So now go back to link. If you think about link to do a database query, you can see, well, I can query the database and I get back my results. But really what you're doing is you're looking at that query as a computation, and as the result of that computation, I get back my rows. And the link query is kind of, you know, describing that computation. Now think about an asynchronous computation where I'm going across the network. Well, there's the computation which says, okay, I need to go across the network, and then there's the result of the value. So in some sense, that value is very similar to a row in a table where you have a computation and the value that comes out of the computation. And so by making that distinction, we are able to generalize this. It sounds very abstract, but the funny thing is that, you know, by doing that, suddenly things that look very, very different become the same. And that's kind of what fascinates me, is that you think that these things have nothing to do with each other, but by taking a step back, you say, hey, they're actually the same.
Mm-hmm. And so all this has to do with how we're dealing with the cloud and doing cloud computing, because it needs to distribute its load into the different resources you might have on different servers.
Yes. So the cloud, I think there's a big change coming. It's already happening, where we are, and some people would argue it's not even a change because we're going back to the time of mainframes, where, you know, the computation was also centralized, and then you would have clients. So in some sense, we're going back into this circle, but computation is getting distributed. So what you need to do is now you need to coordinate between these different computations. And that's where I think it's this idea of distinguishing between the values and the computations, because we have to now focus on coordinating and combining computations instead of coordinating and combining or combining values. Mm-hmm.
This has been a great discussion we've had, talking about all the aspects of languages and how people need to take and be a little more flexible and let the languages be more flexible yep. themselves. We're running out of time, so it's time to get on to the what we call the mantra questions, the common set of questions we try to ask all of our guests to kind of get a little more insight into what they are. So the first mantra question we have is, what book would you like to recommend that everyone read?
Okay, so I brought actually two books. Because I cheated, I cannot make a choice. Well, this one is a technical book. This is called Introduction to Functional Programming by Bert and Wattler. This is, the ideal book on programming. If you want to learn programming at an abstract level, this is the book you want. The book is out of print. So what I've been doing is I've been kind of buying all the books, and then you see the price go up, and then I wait for a couple of months, and then I buy some more. I think I have like 5 or 10 copies at home, and then I give them away. So maybe we'll see a spike in the price after this show airs of this book, but I can really recommend this book to everybody.
So it's a book they find on eBay perhaps or something?
eBay
like that.
Or Amazon or...
And how old is it?
It's from, I don't know, I think it's from 81.
Okay, well, it's not that old.
88.
Yeah. Wow.
Okay, so that's the technical book. And then this is a book called The Change Function. And this book really changed my life. When I said a number of times that I moved from taking theory and looking for practice to going to practice and look for theory, this book has a very interesting thesis. What it says is that there's two ways to predict whether technology will succeed. One is the geek formula, and it says it's the product of 10 times better, so my technology is 10 times better than the old, and Moore's law, which means, version 1 sucks, but version 2, then it will be better. And so you're completely overestimating the chance of success. And if you look at geek stuff, that's what we always do, right? We always say, oh, this is new, this is 10 times better, and yes, the future will be even brighter. Then what he says in the real world is it's completely the opposite. It's the ratio between the perceived pain to the perceived crisis. So it's like, what is the problem that I'm facing? And it doesn't have to be a real problem. As long as the customer thinks it's a problem, it's a problem. The ratio between that and the perceived pain of adoption. And again, it's perceived pain of adoption, but the pain of adoption. And so if the pain of adoption is high, people won't use it. And if the pain of adoption is zero, then the chance of success is infinite. And so I've been really influenced by this book. So what I've been trying, that's when you asked me, am I trying to push Haskell? Well, Haskell would be the geek thing. It's 10 times better. And, if we have a great implementation, in the future, everything will be okay. That was the old Eric. The new Eric is saying, no, I'm using the change function. I want to look at what is the crisis that people face, and then have something with zero pain of adoption. So that's why I'm taking these ideas, trying to look at people's problems and say, do I have a solution here? And can I now make it in such a way that the pain of adoption is zero?
Mm-hmm. So what we sometimes refer to as frictionless adoption.
A frictionless adoption, yes. Yeah. And so this book is really, explains that very well. It has a lot of examples. And so I completely changed the way I look at technology. And
now, is that book in print still?
That book is still in
print.
And you can probably find it secondhand. The last time I looked, it's like $2 or something. So there should be no limitation to buy this one.
Okay. So the second question, if you weren't working in the computer industry, what would you think you'd be doing today? Besides working in a bottling plant.
Well, as you can see from my shirts, but not from my hair, I'm really a hippie. If I could, I would have long hair. So if I wouldn't work in computers, I'd probably have some kind of organic farm or live off the grid somewhere in a commune or
Yeah, I've been kind of noticing the tie-dye. That seems to be like a signature of yours.
Yes, I really like tie-dyes. For several reasons. Well, first of all, I think I like the bright colors. The other thing is that there's this nice mixture of surprise and regularity. So if you look at them, you know, they're kind of fractals here.
I was noticing the fractal sort of looks on that.
Yes, but on the other hand, you know, if you look at it from a more distant, like this one, you know, there is a regularity in it. So that is the kind of thing that I like about it. It's again, it's the theory and practice, this kind of tension between the two. But yeah, so I would be happy. I'm trying to do that on a small scale. At home, we have like backyard chickens. We have six chickens in the house. We have a big vegetable garden. But that would be definitely, you know, what I would
sort of thing
like to
doing.
Do.
No, yeah. Good for you. Good for you. Next one is, what do you feel is the most important technology in today's world?
I think the internet, without doubt, and in particular the fact that the internet makes knowledge available. If I look back when I was a kid, the access to knowledge, we had an encyclopedia, which of course the minute you buy it is out of date, or you would have to go to the library. But now the fact that information is accessible, you know, as you speak, and accessible to everybody. I think
information that is, may not necessarily be correct, but
that is true for all information, and so a lot of people think, oh, you know, like the internet, you have to be careful. But that's the same thing. If you get a book, how do you know that you know you can trust the book?
It's in print. Of course, it's valid.
So I think, you know, probably it also shows, with all due respect, your age, because I think kids today already are much, they kind of, you know, they don't assume that everything they see on the web is correct. But the fact, you know, and Gary Flake has a very nice talk about it called the Internet Singularity, and it says like the fact that there's all this knowledge that's available. That allows us to create more knowledge, which makes more knowledge available. So you get this kind of vicious circle, that's virtuous circle, I should say. It's not vicious. That will increase our knowledge, and I think it's remarkable. And I couldn't live without the internet. And then I think search engines are very important, and I see there's still a lot of room for improvement. Where, I mean, that's what people with Bing, right, a decision engine. Now, the fact that you can search for more than search, but where you can really understand what you're looking for, mm-hmm. And in terms of knowledge. Mm-hmm.
And there's something like where the Mathematica's Alpha comes in,
yes.
Where it's doing something different. It's not really a search engine, but it's still aggregating that information for
yes.
you.
Yes, yeah. But making this kind of knowledge available to people to create more knowledge, mm-hmm. I think that is super important. And if I look in my short lifetime, that is the most radical change that I've seen. Mm-hmm. The other thing is the ability for people to communicate. I can still remember when we lived in the Dutch Antilles that my dad would call his mother. But then he would have to make an appointment with the phone company. And then, yes, on Friday night between 7 and 7:10, he could make a phone call. And it would be, I don't know, like incredibly expensive. So he would be with his watch, you know, because otherwise we couldn't afford it. And now you can IM with everybody in the world at every time for zero cost. Mm-hmm. And I think that also is very important, again, for knowledge sharing and for... I think communication is very important to create, I don't know, peace in the world. And usually these things come because of lack of communication. And by making communication frictionless, I think it's super important.
Mm-hmm. Okay. 25 years from now, what new technology would you like to see be available?
I would say, I think it would be in the area of healthcare. I think we're spending quite a lot of resources on things like machine learning for advertisement and so on, where we're trying to understand, you know, people's click streams and things like that. I think if we would apply those kind of, you know, technologies to healthcare, where we could say, let me give you a slightly different example. Apparently, people on disk drives, they put a little microphone in the disk drive, and then they can infer from the noise from the disk drive whether the disk drive is going to fail soon or not. And why can we do that for disk drives but not for humans? So I think we should really use the technology much more for humans, and not only for humans, and then, you know, transitively for the Earth, mm-hmm. and for, you know, the environment and so on.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the same ratio with the microphone inside the disk drive. You know, everyone wears a watch. I mean, there could easily be some sort of little microphone or sensor on the watch to keep track of what my blood pressure is and stuff like that, and constantly updating to my doctor.
Yes. So I really think that we, you know, if we would be more creative using technology, you know, to improve the well-being of, you know, the planet and the humans and, you know, the environment and everything. Or when things I'm excited about is when you think about the smart grid, where we're trying to optimize, you know, how electricity is generated and distributed. So let's try to use, you know, all the things that we use now to, say, for a commercial use. Let's try to, in the end, I think, you know, the fact that we're human beings and we live on this planet is much more important, mm-hmm. For our survival. And so that's 25 years from now, I hope that, you know, technology is centered towards, you know, the Earth and the people.
The human condition.
And the human condition and the animals and et cetera,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And for the last question, we have a little fun little project for you.
Yep.
And that is, we'd like you to draw your favorite data structure, explain it, and then make sure you put a little Picasso there at the bottom.
All right. So my data structure is I'll use it like this. So it is a very strange data structure.
Okay, so let's see if we get an explanation of this then.
What
does that mean?
So this is a recursive delegate. So this is a delegate, D, that takes as an argument a delegate of the same type, and it returns as a result a delegate of the same
type.
And this is the domain equation for the untyped lambda calculus. And this data structure is remarkable that all computable functions, so every program that you can write in C# or VB can be expressed with only this delegate. So this is the universal data structure, the universal computer right here in one data structure. Another interesting aspect of this data structure is that you cannot really visualize this. So like if you have a linked list or something, you can draw a picture of how that's laid out in memory. Drawing a picture of this data structure here is pretty hard. So I think this is definitely my favorite data structure, the domain equation for the untyped lambda calculus.
To me, it almost sounded like if you actually tried executing this, it would turn into a black hole or something like that.
Well, that's what you would think. But like, for example, there's something called Church numerals, where you can represent the number 5 by a function. And so, you know, you can represent the number 5 by 5 applications of this function to itself. So yes, you don't go into a black hole, but it looks like it is. But yeah, and people were actually, for a long time, this was an open problem where people thought that this was a contradiction, that you could not define this because it's something that takes itself and returns itself. Mm-hmm. And then Dana Scott invented, you know, continuous functions to kind of solve these domain equations. Yeah, so there's a lot of deep theory behind this. But yeah, it's my favorite. I would tattoo this kind of on my shoulder.
Have you?
No, I haven't, but if I would tattoo anything, it would be this one.
Well, thanks, Eric, from the Technical Community Network for being our guest today. And we hope all of you enjoyed this chance to look at the technology and the person behind the code.